go ahead. You were starting to tell me something.
Yes, a little background. ethnicity, what it makes that ethnicity, how it started, and how it functions even today. Ethnicity is in many ways related to the other term known as nationalism. Actually, it's the same thing in two different stages. What makes ethnicity is a group of people linked together with common language, common history, culture, traditions that have a long history behind and is deeply rooted in the psychology of these groups. The United States is, in my opinion, a country that represents probably the largest group of ethnics that are known to live in one country. I may cite you briefly some statistics of the ethnic groups in Detroit. In 1930, 13% of the Detroit population was Polish, 11% was Canadian, 8% was German, 4% was Italian, 4.5% English, 2% Russian, 2% Scottish, 1% Irish, 1% Hungarian, 1% Yugoslavs, 1% Czechoslovaks, 1% Austrian, 0.5% Belgian, 1.5% Greeks, Finnish, 0.5%, Syrian, Lebanese, 0.5%. These are the population of Detroit alone, ethnic population. But they do reflect very much through major cities of the country. Mm-hmm. The biggest ethnic groups with a long tradition came from Europe, of course. The Irish was big thing. And the reason they came here is, first of all, England invaded Ireland. English lords took possession of a lot of land, and the peasants had no land or very little land. So they moved to the United States seeking employment, seeking jobs. And of course there was a need for work in the United States because in the 18th century and the country was being industrialized, and two things were needed here badly: capital for industrialization and labor force. They were agents sent to Europe during that period, all between 1885, 86, and 1913. Agents were sent to Europe to solicit help. And these people who did not have money to pay for transportation got a ticket on the ship, were brought here, and given jobs, and they had to pay for it later. But that was very rapid influx, plus Irish, then German, Poles, Yugoslav, Russians. The biggest influx was actually in 1913, just on the eve of the war. These were the poor peasants mostly from Poland, mostly poor peasants, either had very little land or no land whatsoever. They came there looking for jobs, and here they found jobs, there's no question, there was real demand for them. My oldest brother, who left Poland before the rest of the family, about 7 years earlier. When we came here, my family, in 1913, he was then already not only working, but working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. And that was a good portion of the people, it was in Peckinghouse in Chicago, good portion of the people, workers, worked these hours. Others worked 10 hours. 8 hours was unknown to completely. Mm-hmm. Most of these people who came here did not intend to stay here permanently.
Oh, is that right?
No. They came here to earn some money and return to their country to buy a piece of land or maybe go buy a house or something like this.
Okay.
And for example, took no interest in learning English, no interest to obtain citizenship, because for most of them they were staying here temporarily. But they brought with them this hunger for their tradition. So they established churches, the Slav groups from Poland, for example. They built huge churches all over the country. They built newspapers. In Chicago, there were 4 daily papers in 1913 in Polish language. 4 of them, daily papers in one city alone. In Detroit, there were 3 of them. In 1920, there were 20 daily papers in Polish language in the country, and half a dozen weeklies, national weeklies. Mm. These people were hungry for learning. Many of them were illiterate and learning here to read. Mm-hmm. They also were hungry for Polish literature. They organized theaters. In Chicago, in that year of 1913, that's the year I came with my family at the age of 10, they had 9 Polish theaters playing 7 days a week. To these people, it was something unusual because in villages in old Poland there were no theaters. And my part of the Poland that was, at that time there was no Polish state, it was part of Austro-Hungary. And the city of Przemysl, very old city, there was a very nice theater there. But in a village, I was born in a village just a short distance from the city, there was no theater there. In fact, during the time when my parents were young, there were no schools, so my parents were illiterate actually. When I was young, yes, there was a school. I attended a school for 2 winters. Why winters? Because in early spring I had to go work on the farm, and late in the fall I had to work on the farm until the snow came down. So it was only winters. In 2 winters I learned to read. I respect that Catholic nun who, in that short distance, taught me to read and read well, and I could use them when I came here. But that was the problem. So here they organize not only churches, but also educational institutions, cultural institutions. They had choruses, a dance group, put on their all native costumes. That was a deeply rooted tradition to it. But they all were planning to go back to Poland, and the other were the same thing. But when the war took place, And right after the war, they thought this is the time to go back. They had some savings. How much, I don't know. And they went back, most of them went back, and it looked like there will be nothing left. But they didn't stay back for very long. The fact is, they didn't have enough money to buy any amount of land that they could make a living out of it. Some of them went into business, lost that money. Most of them returned to the United States. Mm. And in 1926, two things happened that made big change. One was that most of these people came back by that time. And second, that the Federal Congress passed an act to limit the migration very sharply. So new migration. Mm-hmm. But those who returned, they were permitted to return.
Oh.
They then start applying for citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
They start learning English. They start drifting away from the Polish or the whatever the native language they had, the papers, starting to read in English. That was a slow change, but constant change and very important change. They're determined to remain here. Now, where were these immigrants occupied? The first industry that came was mining. The Irish did that, the English did that too, and the Poles and the other Slavs did that.
Mm-hmm.
I recall Mortimer, who was later on in the UAW first vice president. He was a miner by trade. His father was a miner. He was Welsh. Mortimer was born here, but his father came from here. And there was a mine that was not organized. And his father sent him when he was 14 years of age to work in that mine there. And when he did get a job there, he discovered that every miner didn't speak English. They all spoke Polish. So when he came back to his father, he says, how can I organize them? I can't talk to them. Learn their language. And he said that these Polish miners there, who in Poland they were not miners, they were just ordinary farmers, peasants as they call them, took interest in him. And the fact that he took interest in them, they taught him Polish enough that he could communicate.
Mm-hmm.
And in a short time after that, they had them all organized. And they had a lot of confidence in him,
mm-hmm.
because he took interest in them.
Mm-hmm.
So mining, then the next industry was railroads, packing houses. That's where my family in Chicago, located in what was known as the stockyards, the yards of the packing industry. And it was a big yard, miles apart.
This was on the south side, was this on the south side of Chicago? South?
47 Ashland, 42 Ashland, Halsted Street. If you know anything about Chicago, you will know where it is located. It's very small now,
mm-hmm.
because they partitioned it since mm-hmm. then.
But it's the south side, isn't it?
Yeah, 47 mm-hmm. South, Ashland, mm-hmm. Western.
My family was from that area.
Is that so?
Yeah, my family is Czechoslovakian.
Yeah, oh,
right. And they were from that area of Chicago.
Well, when during the war, the First World War, two things happened. First, there was the tremendous demand for food, clothing, other things for the war.
Mm-hmm.
And our policy, the government policy, was that we were then, at the beginning, selling those things to both sides, Germany and England. There was shortage of labor. So black people came from the south. Gradually, slowly, they had to locate somewhere, they got to work, and there were no conflict. There was the first introduction and first contact of the ethnic groups, in this case, Lithuanian, Poles, Czech, Yugoslav. The biggest group were Poles, but Lithuanians was the next to it. And black people. Mm-hmm. And they got along very well. And there were not many of them, the black people from the South. They also got them to join the union. There was a drive made to join the union. Two things happened that introduced me into that thing very sharply. First, because my brothers worked there, two of them. My sister, one of them, worked there too in the packing houses. And I was selling papers. That was my first American enterprise, selling these Polish papers on the streets. And I discovered that many of these workers could not read, like my parents could not read. There were no schools there. So they asked me to read for them. Well, and I would get together a group, maybe five, six. They'd pay me a nickel, the paper actually cost me a penny, and I sold for 2 cents, but they would give me a nickel or a dime, or I'd read for them.
Oh, you could get rich that way.
But I discovered it's one thing to read, and another thing to be able to understand what you're reading, particularly when these events were taking place, war were over, mm-hmm. and then internal events. So I was puzzled. They asked me questions, you know, and they could ask questions. People can ask questions, and I couldn't answer these questions. So among my customers for one of the paper, who had a little shoe store, and he was not making shoes or repairing shoes. He was a middle-aged man, and he took interest in me. He always talked to me. So I told him, "Oh," he says, "I'll help you." "In what way?" "Come to me before you have this class of yours, and we'll go over the paper, the news in the paper, mm-hmm. not only one, but whatever they are, mm-hmm. and I'll help you." And he did that. I had that for 3 years. That was practically, I was then 11, 12, 13 years, until almost 14 years. That was the most educational period in my life, actually, because here I was taught to read papers. I was taught how to understand what's happening both domestically and in foreign countries, mm-hmm. where the countries were located, the maneuver, military maneuvers. And that was a very important period in my life, actually. But at the age of 14, I had to go to work because even the fact that during the war, there was everybody in my family worked, and yet whatever we earned was, whatever they earned was very limited. So at the age of 14, we all went to work. That everybody there, all my schoolmates went to work. And that was a custom. But a couple other things happened, you know. We entered the war, and there was quite a division of opinion about whether we should enter the war just like it now, even among these ethnic groups.
Kirsten, I'll take this.
One thing happened. The American Federation of Labor, the General Council in Washington, sent to packing houses Polish-speaking organizers by the name of Jan Kikulski. I remember that name, never forgotten. My brothers would drag me to a meeting and to listen to him speak, and he spoke Polish. And here I was introduced to this problem then first, that for labor, that these ethnic groups, whether they were Poles or Lithuanian or Russians, they had to be organized and Polish-speaking or their language-speaking organized, mm-hmm. because otherwise you couldn't communicate with them. Mm-hmm. And I also learned that many unions, miners, machinists, the amalgamating clothing workers that I learned later, had Polish or other-speaking language, Italian, locals. And the nature was not because there was just national chauvinism or that But that's the only way these people could be organized. You have to communicate with them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what happened was that Jan Kikorski one morning was found badly beaten in front of his house. And he was awake by his family, found him, and he lived very briefly, a few hours, and then passed away. And the only thing that was left was, and he said, that on his way home, a taxi cab came right close to him, and two men jumped out of it and beat the devil out of him, and he passed away. The police made some effort to locate the taxi cab. They did. They claimed they did locate the cab, but he says, I couldn't tell them anything, the driver. They hired me, they asked me to keep on riding around the neighborhood until they saw this man coming. They jumped out of the cab, they beat it, and they rushed back and told me where to go, and then they stopped, and that's all I said. Well, but that was the first thing that I was introduced, the labor, the language which grew, and the fact that here the student organizing obviously was hired to defeat this whole labor drive.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second, another man by the American Federation of Labor, Rokosh's name, I remember these names. He didn't last very long, 3 months. The same thing exactly happened with him, only it happened on Sunday afternoon instead of night.
Mm-hmm.
Right in an open place. Police said that they even saw the thing, and they tried to catch up with the taxi driver or whoever was driving, but they got away.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, as later came, there's only one thing. The attempt was to destroy the union, and they did destroy the union at the end of it. But further things happened. They divided these workers into three locals, they call them, branches. Two of them used Polish language, and they were actually Polish-speaking locals. They had their officers elected, they had their control conduct, and it was also this interesting thing that I didn't know, it was a complete revelation to me, that Lithuanians, who were a big group there, spoke fluently Polish. Why? Because, as I learned later, they were part of the Polish state, they were sort of a united state, and the Polish culture dominated the whole two countries. So they came here and spoke fluently Polish, and they participated in Polish local. Then the Ukrainians who were there, Russians, these are Slav languages. And they learned to understand Polish. They didn't speak too well, but they learned to understand, and that's why they had two locals. But one local was only English speaking, and there you had Irish people who were quite a number of them, and you had Germans. Germans were largely skilled butchers. As I learned later on, most of the unions had these local languages, and they published papers in their languages. And the explanation was only because that's the only way they could organize.
Mm-hmm.
But after the second generation, things were different. Now, two things happened to me. When the war was over, the production suddenly dropped sharply, because a great deal of that production went to war effort. So there was unemployment. And further on, wages remained very much on the level of 1913 before the war started, but wages. But the prices went sky high.
Mm-hmm.
So there was very strong dissatisfaction as well. There was also dissatisfaction because of the veterans who came from the war, who worked there in the packing houses before the war, who lived in that neighborhood. Some of them were married, most of them were single yet.
Mm-hmm.
When they came back, they couldn't find housing for them.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of these houses were occupied by the black people who came from the south.
Oh, okay.
So there's this racist question.
Yeah.
First, the city council of Chicago made a stupid thing on Lake Michigan. And that was a place where people would go on Sunday in summer to swim in Lake Michigan, many of them. They would designate a small piece of that lake where the black people could swim. Mm-hmm. Otherwise they were forbidden to swim in other places. Mm-hmm. Well, one Sunday, a boy, I understand 11 years old, something like this, black boy, who swam little out of that designated space, and he was attacked and killed. A riot took place, a bitter riot. I don't know how many black people get killed, how many white people get killed. The governor of Illinois sent the troops there. It was a horrible thing. Also, when in relation to the strike, another horrible thing in relation to this racial relationship was that they brought from the South, the company, and trains, brought them and located them in some unknown places. Then they would bring them to the packing houses by elevated railroad to go to work when the packing of workers were on strike. Mm-hmm. So the pickets would attack them, and there was a bloody fight. Mm. And then that was actually...
What year are we talking about now?
That would be 1919, actually. Okay. This is right after the war. Mm-hmm. Actually, that was the first encounter of these ethnic groups from Europe, Eastern Europe, largely. Mm-hmm. Of course, Irish was involved in that, and the Germans were involved in that, but the big bulk of them were Polish, Lithuanian, Ukrainian, Russian. This is the first time they were in contact with black people. Mm-hmm. And at first, that thing went smoothly. But when they brought these black people as scabs, mm-hmm. and they didn't know they were scabs,
yeah.
Now, those things, this shoemaker who was reading the papers and the news for me, he explained that to me. It was a revelation to him. Well, the strike...
I didn't know that either.
Yeah, well, the last thing that happened...
They just thought they were getting jobs, and they didn't understand.
Sure, they were looking for jobs, that's all. The last thing that happened is what they call Palmer Raids. Have you ever heard of that?
Mm-mm.
Well, on the eve of New Year, 1920, a raid took place, federal government raid. See, what happened there, now I know because I've made a closer study of it. President Woodrow Wilson, a very interesting individual, he was in office when we came from the Chicago from Poland. And in 1916, he was running for the election on a Democratic ticket. He was known as a liberal, former professor. And he was told the people there that he'll keep us out of war. And he was actually elected on that slogan, mm-hmm. he'll keep us out of war. Soon after he was elected, something happened that also nobody expected it. American ship going to Germany, because we were selling to Germany goods,
mm-hmm.
was dynamited by English. And uproar took place in our country here. How everyone, freedom of the sea, freedom to sell whatever we wanted. Mm-hmm.
So, that was deliberate?
Pardon me?
It was deliberate? It wasn't accidental? I mean, they didn't mistake it?
No, it was deliberate. The policy first was that we'll be neutral and we'll sell to both sides.
Mm-hmm.
But actually what happened, what happened was that when that boat was dynamited by an English submarine,
mm-hmm.
the Prime Minister, whose name I don't recollect now, I have to look up for that, send a message to President Wilson, send us an important man. We'll give you a very important proposition. So he did. Wilson, do you know who he sent? J.P. Morgan, the banker. He was an important man. And the British government made this proposal. You give us a loan, and we will not take anything of that money to England. We'll use all to buy our supplies, war supplies, from you. So you will lose no money on it. On one condition, that you will not sell any more to Germany. Well, Wilson accepted that, and frankly speaking, as I recollect, everybody was happy with it. Bankers were happy because bankers loaned the money and they got good interest in it. The manufacturers were happy because they were not losing anything, they were selling goods.
Mm-hmm.
And the workers were happy because they had jobs. Everybody was working, you know. So this, that's the situation. Well, what happened at the very close of that war? That there was a fear developed that Germany will win that war in spite of it.
Mm-hmm.
And Wilson had to come out and declare a war against Germany, mobilize the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite a sudden thing. But the reason he did, it was obvious to business people. They felt, who will pay the huge loan if England loses the war? So then we would have to protect that loan that we would got in the war. Then Wilson took seriously ill. And that period of 1919, he was so ill that his wife would allow nobody to see him, and she served as a sort of an intermediate. Well, two individuals in the government, particularly one, Attorney General, by the name of Palmer, and a young man who was hardly known, but he was involved in some security work, by the name of Hoffman. They decided that our country was facing a serious danger. What kind of danger? Well, in Russia, a revolution took place. Revolution swept right after war, whole Europe. The Kaiser in Germany was abolished, imperial government in Austria was abolished, and it's true. And in Russia was more than that, it was a socialist revolution. So they came, they have to save the country from conspiracy. And what kind of conspiracy? People were, and actually what happened here was that a strike wave swept the country. For the same reason that these packing houses. Wages were low on the standard of 1913, but prices were sky high. So mass strikes took place, swept the whole country from Boston, Massachusetts to Seattle, Washington. And in Boston, Massachusetts, something happened unusual. Police went on strike. And the governor of the state of Massachusetts, where the individual later became a president, Calvin Coolidge, he sent state militia to disarm the police of Boston, and they had a bloody fight.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on that night, they raided hundreds of halls. They said an official statistic was that they arrested 5,000 people, some said close to 10,000, nobody knew how much. They were raised the halls where these people were celebrating New Year. They searched for weapons, and it was many months later that some figures came up. That on all these searches, they found two guns and no bullets. And these were the people who were threatened to abolish our government. And that is very little said in many of the historians, but there are some who have these facts. But that's It was a period that I developed, learned what was going on in the country. It was a brand new country to me, brand new everything. But this was the introduction. Now coming to the, coming to these ethnic groups, most of them came from poor peasants, very poor families, and they arrived with certain amount of opinions. They were divided in their difference of opinion. Among them, there were quite many socialists, those from the cities, workers. They were a socialist background. That was in Polish, that was in Lithuania, there was the... So when they came here, this shoemaker was one of them. I didn't know that at first, because he didn't say anything about his own background, but I learned in the later. That their relationship to the black people from the very beginning was not a racist relationship. Mm-hmm. Nobody saw a black person in Poland, I never see it, so mm-hmm. on, you know. But what there was in Poland that was of a racist nature, where the minority group was Jewish. Mm-hmm. 10% of Polish population was of Jewish origin. Mm-hmm. So there was a certain amount of anti-Semitism, there's no question mm-hmm. about it. But that was different. But even on this question of anti-Semitism, these workers who had some certain amount of socialist opinion mm-hmm. were not anti-Semitic. And in fact, that was the reason why they did not react to black people. Mm-hmm. And you find later on, when that issue became a big issue, that in these ethnic communities, and I will give you examples as it goes on, there was a segment of these leftist people, or leftist opinion, who acquired some socialist knowledge from Europe. They were not anti-black. They sometimes would be a little hesitant about associating with black people. They didn't know black people, but they were not anti-black people, and they were had some experience with. I can tell you that. So the next part of my life, very briefly, and I'll come to Detroit and Michigan because that's where we had most experience. I spent 8 years working for a hot chef in the Marks at clothing industry. I got a job there through a friend that I met, and he worked there. That industry was organized, amalgamating clothing workers, organized very early. It was a very democratic union. We had many democratic traditions, for example, in that union, there was a Polish local. I didn't belong to the Polish local. They published Polish weekly paper, the Amalgamated Clothing Workers. My local consisted of the workers who were in one shop, and there were variety. There were Poles, there were Russians, there were Lithuanians, there were even Romanians. And there were some who, I don't know what nationality, they spoke English. There came one problem. The union was organized by Jewish workers, largely Jewish workers that came from Lithuania, from Poland, who were socialists in the old country. They organized the union. They provided the leadership. They had enough knowledge, enough understanding. Mm-hmm. So in the shop that I work, the two ethnic groups there were Jews, largely Polish Jews, and Poles, American Poles, over mm-hmm. the young Jewish generation. 2 years after I started working there, and we would elect shop chairman, union, most of that, and we would also every year have new agreement, never more than a year old. A young man, Polish-American, born here, decided that he's going to run for the office of the shop chairman. And he started very openly. He says, the company is Jewish, the manager of the shop here is Jewish, and the union is Jewish. So the leading Jewish workers there, both the chairman of the union and others, they came to me and they said, look, here is the situation. This will split the union. You will have to run for a chairman. Why me? Because you're not anti-Semitic. I didn't even know what the terms meant. But obviously, since we watched you here, as you came, you are the one that can do that job. And they insisted, and I said, look, I have very little experience. I had no experience in that. We know that. We'll teach you, we'll work what you do. So I accepted it. When the nomination came on the floor, I accepted the nomination. The other individual withdrew. He knew that that campaign will not work. Mm-hmm. So I became a chairman of this. And actually, these Jewish people did a tremendous thing for me because they did exactly what they said. They taught me, they worked with me every time there was a problem, we would meet together, they would teach me a lot of things, they brought literature and Polish for me. And I worked until 1929, the Depression there. And what happened, we had this provision in the contract, that during a layoff, no one was laid off, only the work was divided. So, in that group where I work, and I wasn't paid by the union, I was paid by my work, I had to do my work. The whole section, 18 of us, divided, one would work 1 week, and the other worked with the second week. Well, it got so bad that we would have 1 day in 2 weeks to work. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, what's the use? It's just waste of thing. I wanted to go back to school. I had very limited education. I wanted to go back to school. And I thought I'll do some traveling. I haven't seen the country yet. So I quit. And before I decided what to do, one morning, I found the paper, Chicago Daily News. Chicago Tribune, that's what it was, yeah. Daily News, flaming headline. 17 banks closed. And one of them was my bank. I was left with $50 to my name.
Oh, dear.
And so for the next 3-4 years, I had hardly any income at all. I hardly had a job. But I devoted my time mostly to organizing unemployed council. And what we did with these unemployed councils was that whenever people was evicted, and many of them were evicted, we would go and take those furnitures that were thrown on the street back to the house. So they would take us to court and we explained to the judge, and many of the judges didn't know what to do. They were sympathetic, they understood that here these people were evicted because they couldn't pay rent. Or they were evicted even if they owned this house, but they were unable to pay whatever they had to pay. So some of the judges would simply say to me, look, don't bother when the police are evicting them. We have to issue these orders, we can't do nothing about it. But after the police disappear, whatever you do, that's your business. We arrived at an understanding with the police, what we do, because there was a general sympathy for these poor people. So then the last few years, about 3 years I spent like that, and I made tour. And the advantage I had there too, that I could speak Polish, and I spoke Polish in English then already in these meetings, and there was quite a demand for them. And these people took very good care of me. They would clean my clothes, the women would, they would feed me, they were. So until I arrived in Detroit, I was to come here frequently to Detroit, and finally I decided I'll settle here and stay here. I had to look for some kind of work. I would just my clothes were going to pieces. So I saw an ad in the paper, Polish speaking salesman wanted in Hamtramck in one of the stores there. I answered that. I went there in the morning, and there were about 20 young men. There were only one man, but there were about 20 of them standing in front of the house of this store. A man came in. Obviously, he was of Jewish origin. He was opening a paint store called New Enamel, something, New Enamel, something new. So he called us and interviewed us individually. And I thought to myself, he was a Polish Jew from Poland. And he would test whether we could speak Polish, because that was Polish community at that time, it was necessary. And actually what I had to do was to demonstrate in the window that you can do the job with one color, with one cover. So I thought to myself, I'll use my best Polish. I have to do something to get this job. So, but he listened to me. Where have you learned to speak Polish like that? Well, I said, I read Polish literature. I did classical literature. And that's what I acquired. And I was, oh, you're the guy. Oh, yes. But you're Polish. We'll make business here. So I got a job. I didn't work very long because in 1936, the UAW finally became independent union of the American Federation of Labor, had a new officer, and someone came to Detroit by the name of Leo Krytzki, who was a Polish member of the vice president of the Amalgamating Clothing Workers, to who I knew him from Chicago. And we met at a picnic. And the first thing he asked me, what are you doing here? I said, nothing. Well, but then I left. I said, look, I'm selling paint. What do you know about paint? Nothing. He says, why don't you come and work with us? I said, what? UAW, we were going to organize auto workers. What can I do? Look, this is whole Polish community. I didn't fully knew how much it was until I learned later. So that's how I started on his introduction, Leo Krytzki. He brought me before the board, together with the support of Homer Martin, who was then the president, and I met Homer Martin at that picnic too. He was there. They were speakers at that Polish picnic. And they recommended me, and I was one of the five first UAW organizers who were put with the assignment of concentrating on Polish community. And there were, one realized, because things have changed, that in those days, and such factories as Dodge is out of existence now. Half of the people who were Polish workers, born in Poland, understood English, but spoke very little. In the River Rouge plant, Fort, 20,000, over 20,000, were of Polish origin, also understood English, but did not speak English. And the question is, how do you get, Walter Ruther was on the board, says, I work in many shops, there were Polish workers everywhere. So how do you approach to organize all of them? That's the question. And there were at that time two daily papers in the Polish language here in Detroit. So I made a contact with one of them and win their support. But the question, how do you get to this whole Polish community? There were 9 Polish radio programs. The position was, you buy that time from the station and you accept ads and you finance that way. Among them was someone I knew from Chicago, who was an actor by profession, and here he had a program like this. I went because others, I interviewed quite a number of them. They said, no, UAW, no, they were anti-labor. Well, this fellow said yes. So I started and spoke twice a week on that Polish program. Of course, the procedure was this. that I had to write this speech naturally in English. It was translated into Polish, and then I would deliver it in Polish. Well, that was only part of my work. I had to organize meetings, to speak constantly. We were debating whether to organize Polish locals. We even temporarily started, and then we disbanded that. That was unnecessary, too late. It would only divide the workers. So we organized Polish-speaking organizing committee instead of local. And locals went to whatever shops they were in. Well, up against a very difficult problem because there was so much to be done. And I have never before had that experience of organizing that many workers. For example, this radio.
Were you only responsible for the Polish workers?
Yes, I was alone. There was five international organizers, they call them international.
But only of the Polish people?
I was the only one, the Polish. Mm-hmm. So, this is where Margaret came, very, very useful. I would dictate the speech to her. She would take it and editorialize to see that it's perfect in English. Then I got hold of an old associate of mine, friend of mine, not a socialist, not a leftist, but sort of a liberal and friendly to labor, who would put it into good Polish translation, and then I would deliver it. Mm-hmm. You know, it took that many people to work on that, and yet I had a lot of other things. But that grew very rapidly. Mm-hmm. You see, that period was a period of a mass upheaval. And unless you understand thoroughly what it was, thousands of people came in. Most of them had no experience, no knowledge.
Now, what year are you talking about now?
36, 37. Okay. That's when this Flint situation took place.
And at this point, can you tell me what was the ratio of black workers to white workers?
Yes, yes, I can tell you this. In General Motors, there were no black people at all.
For example,
one of the shops that I, as a shop, had in responsibility for at Turnstead, 13,000 people worked there. There was only one black man who cleaned the cars for the officers of that kind of work, one black person. Cadillac had the department of, let me see that again, term now, heavy worker, the melting.
Oh, okay, the foundry.
Foundry, that's the foundry. There you had Poles and black people. Mm-hmm. And the problem came, I recall very well, the individual in charge of it, the Scotchman by the name of Dave Miller, comes to me and he says, we have all the Poles in that foundry organized, but we cannot touch the black people. Why? They won't talk to us. Mm-hmm. Can you do something for them? Well, I said, let's see. I saw these Poles there, I got talked to them. And they said, yes, we all joined the union, we listened to your talk and so on. What do you do with your black people? He said, I don't know, we don't know what to do with them. And then one of them says, they have an organization here, sport organization, these black people. There's one individual who is sort of a leader of it. Mm-hmm. If you can talk to him and win him over, you'll have the whole black community. So they gave me his name. His name was Keys. I still remember that. My memory of lately
was Keys?
Keys.
Keys.
I went and visited him. I visited him once, I visited him twice, and I talked to him, and he told me all about the sport organization they have. But he admitted when I asked him, if you take up questions of wages, of complaints of it, will the company listen to you? No, those things are out of question. They give us uniforms to play ball, they do things, but wages are not our question. So finally I convinced
them. Oh, so that was how they pacified them?
Sure, yeah. Mm-hmm. So finally I convinced him, and he says, bring me an application, and I think I will have it them sign. You need to, he had them in a month time, the whole thing was organized. And here you had, in my opinion, this, a very close, good, friendly relationship between the black people in the foundry and the Poles. Mm-hmm. We found that also at Fort, where there was also, at Fort, there were more black people than in Kerala. Because General Motors generally did not employ black at all. But the issue of black people came in the following way. When I was elected to the Michigan Senate, and that too, I was elected to the Senate not because I wanted to be elected to the Senate. And we had this problem. The Ford workers were so intimidated and frightened to come to any union meetings that we could only bring them to small home meetings, and we were not making any headway. But they would attend to public meetings of the Democratic Party, picnics. Mm-hmm. So the idea came at our meeting of that committee, an organizing committee, I was a part of the committee, that if one of us would run for some public office on that Democratic ticket, we could speak to these people, because that was quite freedom of the, not much of a restriction. Mm-hmm. So our unanimous opinion was, look, you're the only Polish guy here. So I became a candidate. Mm-hmm. And something unusual happened that we did not expect what would happen. These very Ford workers came, organized my campaign, raised money for the campaign. And there were Sundays when I would speak at 5 picnics. Something I could never do these days. When I speak once, I'm through. And it ended, and I was elected to the Senate. Well, that was, to me, entirely new job. I knew very little about legislative work. I knew very little about the different problems that legislatures face, particularly with labor. I had a lot to learn. We went naturally with Margaret to Lansing at the session, and my first experience was that a very prominent lawyer, Republican, from a small town by the name of Baldwin, introduced a bill to outlaw sit-on strikes. That bill was introduced to the Labor Committee. I was not a member. I could not get on a Labor Committee. They gave me other committees, but not Labor Committee. And the bill was reported to on the floor. But before that, they usually print the bill, and each of us would get a copy of the bill weeks in advance. So I took this bill with me to some of the attorneys I knew, and particularly Morris Sugar, that name is beloved, you know. So I told Morris, I said, look, how do I approach that in the discussion? So he suggested that it was unconstitutional, because strikes are legal, and he says, develop the whole conception different between legal workers, free workers, and slave workers. Mm-hmm. And we spent hours with him. Finally, that I then when that was came on the floor of the Senate. For a while, there was a Monday evening. The only time they held a meeting in the evening was Monday evening, and the gala was loaded with students from the university. There, they were all expected the discussion on this labor day. So when it came on the floor, was left for a while. Nobody asked for it. Finally, when I raised my hand. The lieutenant governor who chaired the meeting was happy somebody is going to talk about it. So I explained that the difference between free labor and slave labor. And I said, you all know what slave labor means. Sit-down strike is a strike. It differs from the strikes that are outdoors, but the picket outdoors. But it's a strike, and it's legal, it's constitutional. Well, there were 10 lawyers in the Senate, and they all were Republicans, and each one would have a question to ask me. And of course they felt that here I was a newcomer, what will I tell them? And what they did, they repeated the old argument that the sedan strikes break windows, they break machinery, they do all those things. So I answered them, I said, stop and think of it. These people, it was winter, and that was right after that Flint strike, said, it was winter, it's cold. If they break windows, they'll be freezing there. In fact, that's what the management wanted to. They wanted to shut off the heat. Mm-hmm. And they protested, and the management changed their mind. So that's nonsense. You have never seen the factory. Second, breaking machinery. These workers know when the strike is over, and strike must be over, that they will have to work, and these machinery they will have to use. These are tools of production. They are not fools, these things. These workers are not fools. They are not going to destroy their own livelihood. Mm-hmm. Well, a humorous thing happened that these students, they got a big kick out of this discussion. And then finally the lieutenant governor pounded to Gable and he says, if you don't stop, I'll have you evicted from here. They all laughed at it because the sergeant-at-arms of the Senate was elderly man, one man, there was 50 students, big class, young fellow, they laughed at him. So finally Baldwin, who issued the bill, made the motion, we adjourn, we'll take up to in the morning. And it did. They adjourned. In the morning, they passed. We appealed that decision in the Supreme Court. It's on pre-con rule that it's unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. That strikes our constitutional period. That was my engagement in the Senate. I learned one thing, that whenever there was a farm question, labor question, I was on the Public Health Committee, I would have to locate somewhere people who had a lot of knowledge of that subject, and then spend a lot of time learning from them.
Can you tell me a little bit, I want to change the subject a little bit, because I want to make sure we have time for, I'd like to know about your, the time that you met Congressman Diggs.
Senator
Diggs. And yes. And also when you ran for council.
Yes, I have that on the so right now. When I was elected, Senator Diggs was the only black person in the legislature, both houses. We became very friendly from the very beginning. We worked very closely. And one thing that came to mind both of us, that here we have city government, city council, there was never a black person elected to be mayor, and there was never one from an ethnic group elected, either to the city council or a mayor. Mm-hmm. It was always someone who was never a part of any ethnic group, and certainly not black. So we came to a campaign. I think that was in 1941. And at that campaign, who came to the campaign was that woman who became the city council woman, Henderson. Mm-hmm. She ran Dick's office, and Margaret, of course, was taking care of my office. That was the first campaign of a black and white, and of course, I was known as one of the ethnic group, Polish group. And we both got nominated. And I think, twelfth place out of 18, and Dix was in the